In part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programming on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com.
In the WILL severe weather coverage area, a flash flood warning is in effect for Cumberland, Southern Coles, Southern Moultrie, and Eastern Shelby counties until 3:45 this afternoon. And a flood watch is in effect for Ford, Iroquois, and Livingston counties through late tonight. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Soap, textiles, leather, paints, candles, and oil. These were some of the goods provided to the world by American whalers. Eric J. Dolan says, while whaling is today very controversial, it once provided the oil that lit the world. It helped drive the Industrial Revolution, and it transformed our nation. In this portion of the program, we'll look at the history of American whaling. Our guest is Eric J. Dolan, the author of Leviathan, The History of Whaling in America. Dolan's interest in the history of whaling was sparked by an item in his home, an oval box painted with a whaling scene. Dolan wonders what it was like to have been a whaler. The experiences of whalers are part of this story. Do you imagine them seeing the Enterprise as exciting or as a miserable and dangerous way to make a living? Listeners, I invite your phone calls for our guest this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. Eric J. Dolan studied biology and environmental policy at Brown, Yale, and MIT, where he earned his PhD. Until recently, he was an analyst with the National Marine Fisheries Service. He's now the author of three books. His latest, Leviathan, The History of Whaling in America, is published by W.W. Norton. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Eric J. Dolan, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for inviting me, Celeste.
Sure, my pleasure. When did men first begin to hunt whales?
The first country that did it was the Basques back in the 8th or 9th century. They're the first instance that we have recorded of people actually making the business of whaling. And up through the medieval era, it was a huge industry in Europe where they ate thousands of tons of whale meat, and they used the oil from the blubber to light their homes.
Yeah. You begin this book, Leviathan, in the American colonies at the outset of the 17th century. And there's a story in this opening told by a fellow by the name of George Weymouth. And he told of seeing Indians in New England taking a whale.
Right. When the Pilgrims came to Provincetown, the ship, Mayflower, was immediately surrounded by whales, and some of the men on board actually wanted to begin whaling right away, but they didn't have the implements to pursue that. A couple of days later, as the Pilgrims were making their way along the shores of Cape Cod, they saw some Indians busy about a black object on the beach, and when they got closer the next day to inspect it, they found that it was two washed-up pilot whales that the Indians had been cutting up. They'd been cutting the blubber off to melt down into oil. So the Native Americans were actually engaged in shore whaling prior to the arrival of the Pilgrims.
Mm, yeah. How skilled were they?
We don't have much evidence of what kind of whaling they pursued. There's absolutely no evidence that Native Americans took to their canoes and went out and attacked whales in their own element, but there's plenty of evidence that they took advantage of whales that were washed up on the beach. But later on, as the colonists engaged in shore whaling, Native Americans made up an integral part of the labor force, and in each whale boat there would often be 3, 4, or 5 Native Americans who were providing the skilled labor necessary to pursue the whales at sea.
Yeah, and there were orders from officials to leave the Indians alone so they could go out and perform this labor.
Right. In some instances, Indians that were part of the military were given leave to go back to their home community during the whaling season where they provided needed labor.
Did all this mean that Indians and whites shared the bounty of their efforts equitably?
Not at all. Yeah. There was an unfair distribution of the wealth from whaling, even at an early stage. In many instances, Indians became indebted to the white whalemen who owned the boats. They were given a portion of the profits, but it was often much less than the white whalemen the colonists received. And there was another problem. The use of alcohol as an inducement to get Native Americans to participate in the whaling industry led to a lot of early alcoholism and real problems in the Native American community.
Mm. Another first story in the book is that of John Smith. He set out on a trip from England to America in 1614, and now this is 7 years after the founding of Jamestown, and he wanted very much to return to America, and whaling was the stated reason he found to make his way back.
Right. This is a surprise to me, and one of the many surprises I found while working on the book. I knew about John Smith's voyage to America and that he had coined the term New England, but I had no idea that the main reason for the voyage was to catch whales. Whaling was a big industry in Europe, and his backers thought that he could make a lot of money by catching whales and rendering their blubber into oil. He was also on the lookout for silver and gold. He didn't find that. He didn't catch any whales, but the fascinating thing to me about that story is that years later, he wrote in one of his journals that had his men caught some whales, he had planned to stay in America with 10 of them and establish a foothold for a colony. And when I read that, I thought about how American history would have changed had Smith and his men caught some whales. Plymouth Rock would have remained just that, a rock, instead of a touchstone for the birth of the nation. It was one of the most fascinating things that I found while researching the book, and the biggest surprise.
Yeah, I wonder what kind of a scenario played out in your mind as you imagined had his men caught some whales and set up a colony.
Well, probably Nat Philbrook's recent book Mayflower might have been titled something else. Who knows how it would have played out? We can do a thought experiment. It would have certainly meant that the Plymouth might not have been held in the same regard as it is today, and John Smith might loom larger in American history. And who knows what other reverberations there might have been down through time. But he didn't catch any whales, so he went back, caught a bunch of codfish, got some furs, and went back to England and basically spent the rest of his life trying to find a way to get back to New England, which he never did.
Yeah. He set out with the idea of making some money for financial gain. But, you know, it seems to me that reading this story, there are larger economic and political motivations at work. England, for example, you point out, wanted to be a whaling power. What did it mean politically to be a whaling power?
Well, political economic standing often translated into political and international might. And England, at first, was more than happy to take whale oil and baleen from the colonies and use the colonies for many other natural resources that it could provide. But England looked to the Dutch, who were the preeminent whalemen of the time, and the success that they were having, and they realized that a lot of the national treasury of England was heading in the direction of Holland to pay for the oil that England required. And they were not on the best of terms and often were at odds in wars, so they wanted to develop their own potential so they could secure the gains of the whaling industry to the English people. And when they thought about English people, another thing that I discovered that I thought was fascinating is that for a long time, the English, across the pond, as they say, did not view their colonists as equal citizens. They weren't even citizens to some extent, and they were to be used when it was convenient. But when England wanted to develop its own whaling industry, they didn't think of the colonial whaling industry as a subsidiary of England's whaling industry. They, at some time, thought about it as a competitor and rued their inability to develop their own whaling fleet at the same time that the colonial whaling fleet was expanding by leaps and bounds. So it created a lot of friction, but in the end, the English were glad, once they had failed to build up a whaling fleet, that they could rely on the colonials who provide them with the oil and baleen they needed.
Yeah. You mentioned the Pilgrims and the many whales that they saw on their crossing. Is it possible to estimate what the population of whales was in the area of the Atlantic the Pilgrims crossed at the time of their crossing?
The short answer is no. There are many extremely smart and talented scientists and mammalogists who have been puzzling over that question, looking at historical records, looking at genetic records, to try to extrapolate backwards what the populations might have been. And I don't think there's any clear answer to that question. There are different techniques that have been used. But to give you one example, in 1760, a Truro man, and that's out on the edge of the end of Cape Cod, wrote in his diary that when he was a young man, and he was in his probably 60s or 70s at the time, that he remembers seeing so many right whales in Provincetown Harbor that you could literally walk across their backs, sort of like the salmon imagery from early America. Mm-hmm. You could walk across their backs from the tip of Provincetown to Truro. And if you estimate how many whales that might have taken, it's certainly in the thousands. And right now, there are only about 300 to 350 right whales, northern right whales, swimming in the ocean. So the numbers were definitely much, much greater, especially for that species and certainly for humpbacks and other species that frequent the East Coast.
Yeah. Eric J. Dolan, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Leviathan, the History of Whaling in America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. Here are the numbers if you'd like to join us with. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-229-9455. Let's take a call now. A listener in Effingham on line 4. Hi.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call. A very interesting show. Just a quick comment and a question, and I'll go ahead and ring off. My wife and I, some 20 years ago, we spent our honeymoon in Chatham. And in New England, and we took a small schooner across the Nantucket. They have a fantastic whaling museum there. Was wondering if your guest had a chance to visit them, have any comments about it. And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, the answer is yes. I was actually there this past Saturday doing a book signing, but while I was researching the book, I had enough to get a fellowship from the Nantucket Historical Association to spend time on Nantucket. Now, granted, it was in the dead of winter, but I loved it that way because it felt like I was back in time. There were hardly anybody around, and I used to take walks at night down the cobblestone streets and see the old captain's mansions, and I can imagine what it must have been like during whaling times. But I visited the Whaling Museum on a number of occasions. It is a world-class museum, fantastic. And while I'm mentioning it, the New Bedford Whaling Museum as well is world-class, really worth a visit if any of your listeners come east.
Yeah. You know, on this subject, in the beginning of your book, I think it's in the introduction, but you mentioned that there are a number of whaling libraries devoted to whaling.
Yes. The largest is the New Bedford Whaling Museum. They have thousands and thousands of volumes and books devoted in whole or in part to whaling, and tens of thousands of manuscripts, logbooks, and everything else. And there are other libraries around the world that either focus mainly on whaling or have a significant subset of their library that focuses on whaling, such as the Nantucket Historical Association. But the largest and preeminent one is at the New Bedford Whaling Museum. And that was one thing that I had a struggle with when I started this book, because this is not a literature that's non-existent. There have been hundreds of books written since the mid-1800s on whaling, different aspects of it. But I decided that a narrative, the type of which ultimately came out in Leviathan, hadn't been done in quite some time, and there was a good place for it. But all of those books and those logs that were available provided an embarrassment of plenty in terms of stories to pick from. But at the same time, it made it hard to write the book because I didn't want to write a 1,600-page tome. It had to be a readable volume. So I had the pleasure and the pain of selecting what stories the reader would hear, and I hope that I did so in the right way.
Yeah, you did a great job. You had a dream of a job and a nightmare of a job all at the same time.
Yes.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Yes, go ahead.
Just tuned in, and I heard the story about the quantity of whales when there used to be. Can you tell me how many species of whale are extinct since early whaling began that are no longer on the planet?
None as far as I know. The ones that are closest to extinction, certainly the North Atlantic right whale, but none of the great whales which were hunted are today extinct. Some came perilously close, like the gray whale off California, the bowhead in the Arctic regions, and certainly the right whale. Some of the great whales, the sperm whale, which I refer to as the whale's whale because of its amazing characteristics, is in relatively good shape. It's endangered in certain parts. And that's not to say that there aren't many species of whales that are in need of protection. There are. But none of them, as far as I know, were hunted to extinction by whaling.
Wow. Well, that's darn good to know. I know that the International Whaling Commission, under the pressure from some of the Scandinavian countries, and particularly Japan, want to open up the possibility of whaling again. I don't know if they're using for scientific reasons to catch and research whales. Is that still moving ahead, or is it facing enough opposition from groups that see the value of a whale alive rather than as a commodity?
Yeah, well, to answer it quickly, the most recent IWC meeting, there was an effort to overturn the ban on commercial whaling, and it failed. But I want to add, and this is a really important point because I had to deal with it when I started the book, my book ends in 1924, essentially. It's a historical view of the American whaling industry. I decided on purpose not to talk at all about the modern whaling controversy, which deserves its own book and a very different book. And I felt that melding the two, America's history in whaling with the current controversies, very emotional controversies and important controversies over whaling, would be a disservice to the history I wanted to tell and also wouldn't be the book that I wanted to write. So I don't want to talk too much more about this because it's an area that I don't consider myself to be an expert in, and there are many other people who are more passionately committed to the modern debate on whaling who could provide much better answers to any questions that might come up.
By the time you conclude what you've written in 1924, had the technology of whaling, was it still men got into a boat with one or two harpoons and went out and tried to catch the whale, or had they moved to more technological gun-type harpooning?
Well, the answer is yes and no. It depends on who you're talking about. The Americans, they stuck with a lot of the old types of technology. Harpoons were used up until the end. They definitely took advantage of rocket harpoons and other devices that had much more killing power. But it was still the wooden Yankee whale ship, or in the case of the ones that went off the West Coast whale ship and the whale boat that would go out to meet the whale. However, Norwegians, Russians, Japanese, who were whaling at the turn of around the 1900s, and the Norwegians, they were much more innovative, if you could say, about hunting whales. And they started, instead of using wooden ships, they would use steel catcher boats, factory ships, motorized ships, instead of relying on sail power and steam power, and they became much more effective killing machines. And as a result, in the 20th century, these factory ships could kill as many whales in a year as the wooden Yankee whale ships at the height of the industry in the mid 1800s had killed in the better part of a decade. So it was a difference in technology, and it was certainly a difference in terms of impact on the populations. But you also have to keep in mind that the American whalemen hunted primarily right whales and sperm whales, to some extent humpback whales. They left pretty much alone the rorquals, the blue whales, the fin whales, the very large, powerful whales, because in part their technology didn't allow them to catch them and then ensure that once they had harpooned them that they could reel them in effect, and take advantage of them. But the modern whalers went after those very large, powerful whales as well and caused the blue whale population, for example, to plummet.
When they would go ahead and harpoon the whale, and this is looking at the period of history when they would, there was sailing ships, not so much motorized ships.
Mm-hmm.
After they would harpoon the whale, would the whalers process the whale? Would they be able to winch the whale up onto the boat, or they worked it off the side of the ship and just cut off the baleen and the stuff until they got to where it wouldn't float anymore?
Right. The latter is essentially correct. I mean, first they'd send out the whale boat, harpoon it, which was just a means of attaching yourself to the whale. It didn't kill it. Then you'd go on the proverbial Nantucket sleigh ride, which is a fascinating term because whalemen never used it. And as near as we can figure out, it was created by a journalist in the latter part of the 19th century. But as once the whale tired, they would pull alongside, take a lance, thrust it into the side of the animal, look for the life of the animal, the lungs, or an area of blood vessels, and if they were successful, blood would start coming out of the blowhole, the whale would go into its final flurry, it would be towed back to the mother ship and tied off onto the side of the ship. They'd put a cutting stage out, and then the men would proceed to cut into the whale using these very sharp spades. They'd attach the blubber, the sheaves of blubber to a block and tackle and ropes, and they'd pull it up, and they'd cut off large sections, bring it on board, chop it into smaller and smaller sections, throw it into the iron tripods where the fire would render the oil out of the blubber, and then they would take the heads of the whales. If it was a baleen whale, they might cut it into pieces, bring it on board, or if it was small enough, they could bring the whole thing on board, cut out the baleen and dry it. For a sperm whale, they would either take the entire case on board and open it up to get to the spermaceti organ, which had the very valuable spermaceti oil in it, or they would just winch it up a little bit out of the water and start ladling the spermaceti oil out of the head while it was still off the side of the boat. And, of course, they'd take the lower jaw of the sperm whale on board, let it dry out a little bit, then rip the gums and the teeth out of it, put it aside, put the teeth aside for later use in scrimshaw.
This is my last question. And someone else
okay.
I'm fascinated about this spermaceti oil. This sounds like something really precious. What was it used for? Why was it so valuable?
Well, spermaceti oil was used primarily. It was the highest grade of all types of whale oil that you could get, and in the mid 1700s, it became the basis of the spermaceti candle industry, which some have argued is the first trust in America, where these different companies would take the head matter, the so-called head matter, which was the spermaceti oil, and through a process of cooling it and pressing the wax, because the spermaceti oil actually is a wax, and it congeals, but pressing the oil out of it, you're left over with this cake of waxy material, which could be bleached and turned white, molded into candles that were brilliant candles of the age and were much in demand among the wealthier classes and made many fortunes. Also, spermaceti oil, even up through the 20th century, was used in certain key applications to lubricate watches. I understand somebody told me the other day, I don't know if this is true, it used to lubricate certain engines of cars up until the 60s or 70s. During World War I, it was used to lubricate battleship engines because it withstands very high pressure and heat. So it was the most valuable of all whale oils, and the whalemen in Nantucket in particular did a great job of hunting the sperm whale and taking advantage of it.
I'm going to thank the listener for his questions and his interest. Again, our guest this afternoon, Eric J. Dolan, author of Leviathan, The History of Whaling in America. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You call the sperm whale the most storied whale in the ocean, the whale's whale. Why does it continue to capture our imagination?
I think a lot of it, an awful lot of it, has to do with Moby Dick. Mm. I mean, Herman Melville's Moby Dick, whether you love it or hate it, is the closest thing that we can come to a nationwide book selection in a book club. So many people were required to read that in high school or college, and just as many wanted to read it because they had heard about it. And the sperm whale and the Moby Dick himself was a sperm whale, and I think that image was ingrained on people's brains for a long time. But there's something that is so powerful about the image of the sperm whale, especially the lower jaw, the powerful jaw and the teeth, the unusually shaped head, the stories, few though they are, but enough to incite our imagination, stories of full-grown sperm whales, male sperm whales, ramming into a 200-ton whale ship and sending it to the bottom of the ocean. And sperm whales weren't just dangerous from the front, with their jaws or their battering ram of a head. Their flukes, which were referred to by whalemen as the hand of God, could come down with such force they could shatter the whale boat with all the men inside of it. So it's an amazing animal in and of itself. From a biological perspective, mm-hmm. It has the largest brain of any animal. It dives to depths of more than a mile down. It has battles, legendary battles with giant squid, even though we've never seen one. Just every single element of its natural history and its whaling history is full of superlatives. You couldn't create a more charismatic star, so to speak, of the whaling world or the whaling industry.
Yeah, and we still don't know the function of the spermaceti organ. That is so fascinating.
Yeah, well, it's kind of hard to study whales. They're so large, you can't bring them into a laboratory and run experiments, and especially because sperm whales go so deep into the pitch dark depths of the abyss, and we don't follow them there with cameras, it's hard to figure out even how they eat down there. There's still different theories about how they attract squid, and most of the squid that they eat are on the order of 3 feet, not 30 feet or 40 feet. How they attract the squid, how they eat them, because they don't use their teeth for chewing, it's more for just grabbing. And what does that massive container of up to 23 barrels of spermaceti oil that is sitting there in their head, what is that used for? Is it supposed to be a giant shock absorber used for battles between males to woo the female whale? Is it something that helps to generate a sonic boom that the sperm whale can use to stun its prey? Is it something that helps the sperm whale avoid, for the most part, not completely, the bends when they go down to those great depths and then come back up? It's a fascinating story, and many mammalogists and others are busy trying to figure out what the answer is.
Oh, to talk to the animals, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Well, when we think of whaling in America, one of the places we think of as a center for whaling is Nantucket Island, Massachusetts. And this was interesting to one of the many interesting things here in Leviathan, to read the description of the island from a Frenchman by the name of Crevecoeur.
Right.
He wrote, "Would you believe that a sandy spot about 23,000 acres affording neither stones nor timber, meadows nor arable, yet can boast of a handsome town consisting of more than 500 houses, should possess above 200 sail of vessels, constantly employ upwards of 2,000 seamen, feed more than 15,000 sheep?" Well, you get the idea.
Yeah.
Why was Nantucket so successful?
Well, in part, it was out of necessity. Nantucket was founded in 1659, and the island is relatively small, and it's not a lot of great agricultural land on the island. It's basically a leftover of the last ice age, very sandy. There are a lot of fish around the island, but when the Europeans got there, they witnessed the Native Americans were participating in shore whaling, and they knew that whales were very valuable. So the Nantucketers quickly got involved in shore whaling, and then about 1712, there's a legendary story of Christopher Hussey, a Nantucket captain, being blown out to sea and falling in with a school of sperm whales, attacking one, bringing it back to shore, and that launched them into the offshore fishery. And on Nantucket, many of them were Quakers by the middle of the century, Quakers with a vengeance, as Melville called them. They had a very cohesive community which worked really hard. They were shrewd businessmen, and they saw that whaling was their lifeline to prosperity, even as far back as the late 1600s. And once they started down that path, they just got better and better. And even the fabric of the society and the women and children that were left behind when the men went out on these long voyages served to keep the community cohesive and functioning. And when Crevecoeur went there, when he wrote about it in the 1760s, 1770s, he just marveled at this little community. The entire fiber of its being was focused on whaling, and it was one of the most successful whaling ports of the era, certainly in the colonies, and it was a very wealthy community. And it was only later in the 1800s that it got supplanted by New Bedford. But every whaleman, every whaling captain in town in Nantucket was revered by the other people in town, and it was considered quite a social coup to wed a whaleman.
This goes back to something that our second caller said early in his comments and his questions. You know, whales, we think of them, and we think of them as, you know, awesome, and when we see them, breathtaking, if you've ever been on a whale watch and had good luck. Are there accounts of whalers expressing awe and appreciation for the animals, not as prey, not as a source of income, but as remarkable animals?
There are, but they're few and far between, at least in the journals and accounts that I read. You have to keep in mind, this is an era well before the conservation movement, certainly hundreds of years before the environmental movement, at least 150 or so, and they viewed whales as swimming profit centers. And when they got concerned about the depletion of local populations of whales, it was out of a concern for their business prospects. It wasn't out of concern for the inherent right of another species to pursue its own life unmolested. So I came across very few accounts of whalemen who expressed any regret or remorse or trouble at all over the action of killing these beautiful, enormous beasts, as they call them.
Yeah. When I try and imagine myself, put myself back in that time, or, you know, try and set myself there for a moment, I think I would have seen them as monsters.
Yeah. Well, especially if you were a green hand, new to whaling, and you were in a 23-foot whale boat with only a half inch of cedar planking between you and the deep ocean and a potentially angry whale that in short order could destroy your boat and perhaps kill you, yeah, panic is the kind of reaction that you expect from a normal person. And many whales, because they were so alien to the people of the time, and back for many years they didn't even know that they were mammals, that we were closely related. They thought they were fish and leviathans of the deep, and they were always rendered as these fearsome, ferocious beasts, especially the sperm whale. And I agree with you. If I was out there facing a whale in its element, especially after you throw a harpoon into its side and make it angry, I would be scared to death.
Yeah. Well, at least one whaler, after spending a number of years in the business whaling, advised young men to just stay at home.
Right, but that was that had nothing to do with his concern or empathy for the whales, and that's
no,
of,
I know.
But that's
the monster idea and the whole idea of how tough it was to do that work.
Yeah, in the middle of the 1850s, there were a lot of books written on whaling, and it was really fascinating. They sort of broke into two different genres. One was the journalistic effort where somebody who was writing about whaling from the comforts of their home near their fireside could view it as almost like a lion hunt, a great jaunt, a way to throw off the shackles of modern life and go out and be the great hunter. But the whalemen themselves, especially the men who were before the mast, not the captains or the mates, viewed whaling by and large as a filthy humbug. It was a miserable, depressing, tedious way of life, and oftentimes, and very dangerous. And what was worse, at the height of the Golden Age, many of the hired hands, the men before the mast, the ones that did most of the work, after 4 years at sea, they could return to port not only without having earned a single cent, but in debt. And that's why many of them didn't re-up or take another chance on whaling after they came back. And desertions, the desertion rate was very high. So whaling was not a profession that, especially in the middle of the 1800s, that people really enjoyed, I would say, unless you were the owner or a captain or a mate. Now that contrasts with what it was like in the middle of the 1700s when Nantucket was the king of the whaling ports. Back then, whaling was considered more of a noble profession. The disparity in terms of salary or lays, the percentage of the profits from the trip that the captain and the mates would get versus the men who rowed the boats, was not as great as it was to become 100 years later in the middle of the 1800s. And it's sort of like a parallel between what we hear today in the news about CEOs of companies and the people that work for them. There's a huge rift, disparity between their salaries, but 30 or 40 years ago, it wasn't quite as great. And there was a similar dynamic taking place in the whaling industry. So if I had to be a whaleman, which I don't think I would want to be, mm-hmm. I would rather have been one in the 1700s than the 1800s.
Yeah. How is it that you could serve aboard an offshore whaling ship for, let's say, a year and come to shore with not a penny in your pocket?
Well, when you signed up, you got a signing bonus. It could be as much as $75 in the mid-1800s, and that sounded like a great amount. But from that, during those 4 years you might be at sea, or however long you're at sea, a lot of costs would be incurred and would be deducted from that amount. You would have to buy things from the slop chest or on board, clothes, anything you needed during the voyage would have to be bought at an inflated price from the ship itself, and often the captain was the merchant who doled out the merchandise. And then there were costs that were incurred when you went into port. Maybe you took a loan from the captain. And then if the voyage itself was not a winning one and there weren't many profits to share, then the amount of money you got in return to pay off your advance, in effect, was very small. So it was common for a low-level whaleman to come back after 4 years at sea and have earned just pennies a day and sometimes be in debt. But there were instances in which there was a greasy trip, which meant that they had a hold full of a huge amount of oil, and everybody on board made out pretty well. But always it was the captains and the owners and the mates who made out the best.
All the money goes to the company store.
Yeah.
There were many conflicts in North America during this period of time, from the 17th century to the beginning of the 19th century. How did these conflicts affect the whaling industry?
We could imagine to go whaling, you have to be out on the ocean. And during the American Revolution and the War of 1812, certainly the number one power on the waves was England, and we happened to be fighting against England. So it made it virtually impossible for whalemen to pursue their trade during those two wars. The only place that tried to do so and wasn't particularly successful was Nantucket. And during the American Revolution, the way they sought to do that was by getting permits, first from the British, then from the Americans, to go out and whale unmolested. But it didn't work out too well. And finally, when the war ended, the whalemen in Nantucket were having a difficult time making money in the colonies, so they emigrated to Canada, France, and England for some time to pursue whaling there. During the War of 1812, it was the same story. Whaling ground to a halt in the United States, with the exception of some trips coming out of Nantucket. And actually, at the end of the year, at the end of the war, Nantucket seceded from the United States for a brief time, thinking that it would make it easier for them to gain passage to the whaling grounds from the British, who were still patrolling the seas. And then in the Civil War, it wasn't England that was causing the problems mm-hmm. to the whalemen, but the Confederacy. And the Confederate Navy decided that one way to harm the Union was to attack their large whaling fleet at sea and destroy an important part of northern commerce. Mm-hmm. So raiders were sent out specifically to hunt down and burn whale ships, and they burned and sank scores of them during the war. In fact, about 20 or so were burned after the Civil War had concluded because the raider, the Shenandoah, hadn't gotten final confirmation that the war was over and was still pursuing its course, which it had been given years earlier, which was to attack American whale ships and burn them. Mm.
Let's take another call before we're out of time. A listener in Urbana, line one, hi.
Hi. I was curious, do you discuss much about the whaling industry around Long Island and maybe even a little further south, say, around 1640 and after?
Yes, there is a lot of discussion in the book about that. Actually, the first whaleman in America was down off Delaware. It was the Dutch. And then in New York, the first organized business of shore whaling started on Long Island. And Long Island takes up the better part of the chapter that I have on shore whaling. There were some great stories about East Hampton and Southampton whalemen and their altercations with the royal governor over taxes that were to be paid for whale oil brought in. And actually one gentleman, Samuel Mulford of East Hampton, refused to pay the taxes to Lord Cornbury and created a huge dispute. He actually went to England to plead his side of the case. And the thing that was fascinating to me about this story, this was happening in the early 1700s, it had echoes of no taxation without representation. And it was sort of an early shot across the bow that was to become amplified during the American Revolution. So there's a lot in the book about Long Island and New York and some about Virginia and North Carolina and Delaware. It's not all about Massachusetts, and certainly there's some about San Francisco and Hawaii.
Oh, interesting. I'm wondering, did the whale industry move south? I mean, did it actually exist down around the coast of New Jersey or up into the Delaware?
Yes, but I would say it's sort of in the other direction. A lot of it started down there and also up north. But then in the middle of about the 1840s, 1830s, everybody was looking to New Bedford and how much money was being made whaling. So up to 60 ports throughout the United States sent at least one whale ship to sea during the Golden Age, including Wilmington, Delaware, and other ports farther south. So at one time or another, there were ports ranging up and down the East Coast and the West Coast that were going whaling. But if you narrowed it down to the ones that had a major impact, it was largely in Massachusetts, on Cape Cod, in New York, San Francisco, and Hawaii, a lot of whaling done out of Hawaii.
Okay, great. Look forward to reading your book. Thank you.
You're very welcome. One last question before we have to go. When did petroleum arrive on the scene, and how did that figure in the end of whaling?
Well, Colonel Edwin Drake sent a well down in Titusville, Pennsylvania in 1859, and petroleum came back up that sort of launched the petroleum age. By that time, whaling was already in trouble, though. There were other forms of illumination that were being more widely used, such as kerosene from coal, camphene, which is a distillate of turpentine and alcohol, and natural gas. But when they discovered petroleum, which provided a very ready source for the production of kerosene, almost overnight, the market for whale oil just fell through the floor. And it also was a double blow because whale oil had been used for lubrication, but many petroleum byproducts are excellent lubricants. So the only thing that, not the only thing, but one of the main things that kept the whaling industry going beyond the Civil War and up until the early 1900s was the fashion craze and the need for the perceived need for baleen corsets, baleen stays to be used in corsets to transform women into hourglass figures, their figures into hourglasses.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time.
Okay.
Eric, thank you so much for talking with us this
afternoon. Well, thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. Eric J. Dolan is the author of Leviathan, The History of Whaling in America, a publisher, W.W. Norton. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Let's find out what happened today in Kansas City and in Chicago with commodity prices. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Taking a look at the numbers as they settled in Kansas City for the hard red winter wheat this afternoon. The nearby September contract lost 7.75 cents. It finished at $5.86. The December futures were down as well, down 7.5 at 6.01.5 from the soft red winter wheat pit in Chicago. The September contract just a half lower this afternoon. Their settlement price at 6.01.25, the top at $6.19, and their settlement, or their low at $6.01. Settlement once again at 6.01.25, and the SEPs, they were down a half for the soft red. December futures are 6.34, the high, the low at 6.16, settled at 6.17.75, or rather 6.17.25. They finished down 0.75. And the March is 640 top, bottom at 623.75. Settlement price at 624.75, down 1.25 for the day. May contract 627, the high, the low at 609.75. Settlement price at $6.10. They were down 6. And July futures 573, the high, the low at 559. Settlement price there at $5.65.5. They managed a gain for the day of 3.5 cents. From the corn pit, pretty heavy losses this afternoon after limit down losses yesterday, down 12.25 cents, and their settlement price was at 322.5 in the Septembers, the high at 334.5, the low at $3.17.5. Settlement price at 322.5 once again in the nearby September corn, off 12.75 today. December futures were down 11.75, a settlement price at $3.36.75. This is, of course, your harvest month. 348.5 the high, the low at 31.5. December corn settled at $3.36.75 on this Tuesday afternoon, down 11.75 for the day. And the March contract, 362.25 the high. The low at 346, settlement price at 351.25. They were down 10.5 cents. May futures 372.25, the high, the low at 58. Settlement price at 361.75, down 9. And July contract at 381, high, low at 367. Settlement price at 371.75, down 7. September's 383, the high, the low at 72.5. Settlement price at $3.74.75, down 6.75. In December for next year, 393.75, the high, the low at 381.25. Settlement price there down 5.75 at 385.75. March corn 09.